Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
All right, Jack, welcome to the podcast. How are you, brother?
Yeah, good, thank you, mate. Thanks for having me.
Good. Yeah, you and I have been talking about talking and just in general to catch up, and then we decided let's just do it on the podcast.
100%. I think it's a good way. I've watched through some of the podcasts. I definitely like some of the open and honest dialogue, and definitely want to get some Division II representation on there. So absolutely thrilled for you to have me, and looking forward to a good conversation.
Yeah, on Division II is great. I just got off the phone with Kyle Sedgebart, who's at Division I on the men's side. So now we're going to switch over to Division II on the women's side. And I think it's really good for people to hear the different perspectives, because they do get this. There is this, I think it affects the women's side more than the men's side. There is this, if I'm not going to play Division I, I'm just not going to play. I'm too good of a player to settle for anything less than Division I. And it drives me nuts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think on the flip side as well, I do think there is a bit of a, there is a bit of that as well, but I often think sometimes a lot of the Division II schools that you look at are probably a little bit smaller in terms of enrollment than some of the bigger schools. And I think this is a group of kids coming through at this point that I think probably were impacted quite heavily in their emotional growth sort of during the COVID time. So I think being in bigger environments at bigger schools is still something that really stands out to them. So from the soccer side, of course, like I think there is sometimes still that big D1 or bus sort of mentality that we see and that we speak about. But I also do understand some of those players, and especially from coaching club as well as doing the college stuff, that get into really good high academic schools, and sometimes some really good players prioritize their academic side of things over soccer. So for me, with my college hat on, it's really hard to see that sometimes, but then with my club hat on, seeing some of my club kids get into some really, really good high academic schools is good too. So I mean, there's definitely two sides to that one for sure.
Yeah, there is. That's a you've made a really good point. And again, I think these are some of the differences as I switch back and forth on our podcast between men's coaches and women's coaches. Mm-hmm. Some of the differences between coaching guys and coaching gals.
Yeah.
I think that more of the guys just want to continue to play no matter what the level is, and they figure life will take care of itself in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
And 100%. I think on the girls' side, there is this maybe a little more planned out, right? Mm-hmm. A little more organized, a little more planned out, a little more of where they see their lives going. And it's not just about continuing to play. And I think both points can be true. I think life can just take care of itself if you just keep marching forward and not worried too much about the future. I think you can overplan, but at the same time, I think that a well-planned out future can have its pathway too.
100%. And definitely a really good way to do both. I think kids now are getting a lot more intense in their college search in terms of, for me, whenever I have kids on campus to tour and stuff, like I always am very big on the academic side of it first. Like you really have to go somewhere that's going to work for you in that regards. First of all, make sure it's a good program at schools you're looking at. Because if you are ultimately somewhere that you're happy and you're following where you think you're going to go next, it's going to be a lot easier for you to manage the requirements of being a student athlete, to be able to be successful in the classroom and then successful on the field as well, which is such a big part. So if players aren't here struggling and stressing about what comes next and is this the right pathway for me, I think it allows a much better sort of environment for you to succeed in on the field. And at the end of the day, I think if you have a happy kid on your team, a happy player, it's going to allow them to embrace themselves in what we're trying to do more. And I think it just promotes a better level of success, obviously, within the team and the program as well. So it's a very dynamic structure of obviously family, athletics, academics, and hopefully finding the right fit for kids. And I definitely think people are being a lot more conscious when making those decisions now, which is really good. And that's what you want to see, because it's 4 really important years of your life that go by super quick. Like, I'd love to go back and play my 4 years again and really enjoyed it. So it's a huge decision, and it's one that really cannot be taken lightly. And I definitely think I'm a coach that relates that within my recruiting as well. Like, I'm very kind of standoff and low key when I try and recruit, because I want to make sure that players don't feel pressured into making decisions when ultimately you want them to make the right decision for them, because then it will keep them at your program. It will have them buy into what you want to do, and that's such a big part of the puzzle, especially I feel for us within women's soccer.
Yeah, you talk about player retention, and it's funny because you get two sides of the two ends of the spectrum, rather. You've got the one end of the spectrum where we see these schools that are trans, they have 15, 16 kids leaving every year at 4 year schools, and just massive numbers exiting and then bringing kids in. And coaches working primarily out of the transfer portal to bring kids in, but then kids are leaving. And then you've got other schools. I just talked to the coach at William and Mary not too long ago, and they have virtually no kids leaving their program. How has the transfer portal affected you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I've been at Mercy for 6.5, 7 years now. Just finished my third as the head coach. We don't tend to lose too many players to the transfer portal. If we do, there's usually reasons behind it, and ones that we can get behind. So a player this year who has 2 years from injury still remaining, she graduated, and for her, going back home and doing grad school at home is going to be a much better option for her. And we helped her out. We had her practice with us in the spring still. She did her part, and now it's time for her to follow that opportunity that's better for her at home for a variety of different reasons. But again, I think we don't see it as much in terms of our retention is, I think, very high as well. I think players like being here, and I think again that does come from the re recruitment strategy of we want players to absolutely know that they would like to come to Mercy. We know what we're good for. We know what majors are good here. We have a really good location, and obviously having a program that over the last 10 years has been quite successful, I definitely think is a pull. But we know the sort of players and the personalities that we try and recruit, and probably have a mid-sized squad for Division Two, with I think it's going to be 32 on the roster this year. But bringing in players that we think personality-wise are going to bond and be strong and connect well together, I think that promotes them staying here. And again, we have some really good players that probably don't get the minutes that they want. Which is, again, look, you want that fight, and they fight and they push, and that's the reason that allows us to be probably as competitive as what we are. But they stay because they believe in what we're doing here. They like the environment, and again, I think they picked based off of, right, this is a good school for me, and the soccer will follow with it. And I think that's what allows us to keep retention. And still, the transfer portal, I mean, we probably bring in one or two every year from it. I think it's been two this year. And again, every coach has a formula that works for them, right? So there's what works here is not going to work somewhere else. What works somewhere else is not going to work here.
Right.
But for me, I think, especially at the Division Two level, which is very different now than Division One, with name, image, likeness, with obviously the conversations of the 5th year. So I'm definitely very aware of the differences in what is offered and what is reality in the different levels at this moment. But for me, it's just really making sure that you're bringing in the right players, and you're keeping the longevity of it, and staying in our lane of what we can do, right? So I think for me, it's building a program allows us to have a successful team year on year, whereas definitely within the money and the confines of Division One now, it needs to be a good team every year. It can't be a program that for 2 years is building and then gets success, because it's becoming a lot more of a cutthroat profession, coaching soccer, I feel, based off of the turnover rates that we're seeing at the moment. So coaches have to do what's best for them and their program. And I think for me, and for a lot of teams at Division Two, I think they would probably agree with me that building a program is the best way to kind of have successful teams. So that's why I think it's probably a little bit different for us than what it is for some of those bigger Division One programs with more resources, etc.
I think you made some really valid points. Yeah, number one, you talk about you've got 30, 32 kids on players on your roster. Division one, most schools are capped at 28. Not all of them, but most of them are. Most have opted in. And believe it or not, for people out there going, oh, what's the difference between 28 and 30? It's a big difference.
A
When you
big
talk
difference.
about injuries, which we're all plagued with, every team's plagued with 2 to 3 injuries at a time, players that aren't going to be able to compete this week. When you talk about discipline, being able to, if you're down to, the three goalkeepers, right, are automatically puts you two players short of being able to play in any given day, really. So all of a sudden you're down to, 20, 26 available players, and then you've got three injuries. Now you're down to 23. If you've got players that need to be disciplined, which most of us do for one reason or another, right? They didn't go to class, or, they're struggling academically, or maybe they broke a team rule, or maybe they broke a school rule and they need to be disciplined. If you've got one or two of those going on at a time, man, all of a sudden you can't even play 11v11, which makes it hard to train and prepare. So, Division One schools are kind of handcuffed in a way, like you said, with the 28-man roster. They need every player possible being able to, yeah, if she starts for me today, well, I'm not going to freak out. We the day of, yeah, I'll take these three players on my roster and we'll redshirt two of them for sure, maybe a third one. We'll have that conversation early on with them, and they'll be great when they're juniors, but it's going to take a couple years for them to develop. Can't happen at the Division One level like it used to. And that's the advantage that a Division II program has, or an NAIA program, or junior college program, or Division III program. That's the advantage that those programs have, is maybe they can take in a player that's cl clearly not ready right away to make an immediate impact. But in a year or two, that player can impact us, and in the meantime, can still be part of something that we're building.
100%, and I think as well as that, when you look at like specifically Division Two and Division Three compared to Division One, the Division One season goes on at probably it's only 2 or 3 weeks, and that doesn't seem like a lot. But where our seasons are condensed, and realistically, I'm playing Saturday, Wednesday, from our first game to our last game. Players need rest, players need recovery, and for me, if you have 28 players on the roster and you have 8 players that play 70 minutes on a Wednesday and you're going again on a Saturday, I know I can't put them through a full session on the Thursday. So when you take
Right.
that out and now you've only got 18 players at a session, and
Right.
then we've got a really good nursing program here at Mercy. So on a Thursday, we might not have some of our players because they're in clinicals. Then on a Thursday, I go from having what is 22 players available to then 12 that can practice. And my ability then to keep those players that maybe didn't play on the Wednesday in game shape because we might be playing a different opponent where someone might need to fill a role and we might switch up who's playing. We're then not giving them what they need also. So I think, and again, I'm not someone I don't have a vast array of assistant coaches and things like that. So I wouldn't ever go, probably 32 is probably 2 players more than I would have liked going into this year, but it's just the way it's kind of gone for us. But I can't have that many players on the roster and be where we are with things. So it's 32 is a really good number for me, but the 28 one, I definitely do see some issues and understand with it, especially with the 5 year thing being spoken about again. I think that's going to obviously set recruiting back a little bit as well, which I mean, only time will tell, right?
Yeah, and I haven't, well, Division Two, consider, so when you're talking about the 5 year, for those that are listening that aren't quite sure what we're talking about 5 and 5, which means you'll get 5 years from the date of graduation, or 19 years old, whichever comes first. You'll get that to play 5 years, kind of like they do in Canada. That's what they do in Canada. They give them 5 years. And Division Two was actually the first division to take a vote on it, and they decided to table it until 2028, I think.
I think
And
so.
maybe that'll get revisited. I think it will. I think if Division One passes it, then I think Division Two will very quickly reconsider whether they want to do it. I don't think they'll wait till 28. And I think if Division One passes it, I think Division Two will pass it. I really do. Division One and Division Two are fairly closely aligned in many ways. And Division One typically leads the way, which is all fair enough. Division Three, I'm not sure we'll ever pass it. It's just a whole different purpose for being, is the way that many Division Three schools think of themselves. And I think the way the Division Three in general, the leadership council thinks of themselves as sport is here simply to augment the academics, not necessarily coincide with per se, but it's a way to let students blow off steam and have something else to do and to supplement the education piece, which we'll all agree that the education piece is really important. But the way that many students, I don't know, myself, my son, a lot of players that I know really only went to college so that they can continue to play. And that's why they went to school.
And that obviously has to remain the forefront of it. Like I don't particularly think I have a strong opinion either way on the 5-in-5. Like I think the structure that we have at the moment obviously does work very well, and has done for a long time. But do I understand it as well? Yeah, there's waivers coming everywhere, there's conversations everywhere. So definitely conversations that are way above my pay grade. But no,
There.
I'm very interested to see what happens from it, especially when I was a student athlete myself. I served on the NCAA Division II Student Athlete Advisory Committee, and then from there I was one of two of the students that were on the management council as well. So being privy to some of the conversations at that level was definitely an eye-opening experience for me, and made me really want to continue working in collegiate athletics as well. And that's why I love being able to be an assistant athletic director here as well, because I get to stay involved with the student athletes in general. So being privy to some of those conversations and how in-depth discussions are had, and the real thought of it, like I do firmly believe, especially at Division Two, that there's a lot of people in charge of the governance that really do want to make it the best experience for the student athletes. And I think that trickles down to the institutions that are in here too. So definitely a lot of trust for the people that are making those decisions. So we'll be interested to see where it goes, and what happens if Division One do choose to put that into legislation, and to how quickly the conversation of Division Two following suit will commence.
And it is all speculation right now, and it does drive me crazy online when I see people on social media that, oh, this is happening for sure. It's like, no, it's not a done deal yet, and we don't know all of the other details either about the ages that they're proposing, because that's I don't see this on the women's side, Jack, as much as I see on the men's side. But on the men's side, we see, 24-year-old freshman with only 1 or 2 years of eligibility coming in, and all they're doing is, frankly, all they're doing is trying to extend their careers because they want to play pro and they haven't made it. So they're trying to just keep that clock running and see if they can catch somebody's eye at some point. But we don't see that as much on the women's side, not even close.
No, I'd agree, and that was really the same kind of when I played, back in 2015 to 2019 was my college career, which I say to my players sometimes, yeah, I can resonate with you guys because I was a student athlete not long ago. But I think next year when I turn 30, I'm going to have to stop using that one. But when I play, we saw it in the men's game 100%, especially I think the men's. Although the women's program is getting the women's game is getting slightly more international, I do think the men's game, there is a real heavy international core of players, and you see a lot of those players coming over from Europe that are coming over and as 22, 23-year olds. And the truth with that is men against boys at that stage. When you're 18, you're playing against a team full of people 5 or 6 years older than you. Like sometimes for us, that was very It was intimidating, and we knew what we were coming up against, but it doesn't prepare you for that different level of physicality. So, yeah, I'd be lying if I said I wasn't glad that wasn't something that we had to deal with in the women's game, because I know as a player it was definitely something that we found quite intimidating, especially my freshman year when I'm 18 and I'm playing against a striker that's 26 and 6 foot 4, and very good for that matter. And this was at Division Two at that stage. So, yeah, definitely happy that that's not something that we see too frequently in the women's game.
Yeah, and even the international thing. I mean, yeah, we get international players coming in on the women's side, but it's only, 15% as opposed to almost 40% on the men's side. So, and I think part of it is that it's only fairly recently that European countries and South American countries and even Australia and such have started to care about the women's game. It's only in the past 4 or 5 years. I remember a recruiting trip I took down to Argentina back in 2013, and when they heard that I coached men and women, that they would look at me, it's like, well, why do you coach women? What's the point? Like, literally, that was their, what's the point of women playing sport? And that was relative, 13 years ago, not that long ago, that many European countries and South American countries and really felt that it was a waste of time, effort, and energy for women to play sport. And take us to 2026, and man, what a change that it's had. It's no longer a foregone conclusion that our American women are going to win a World Cup. It's
No,
no longer a done deal of, well, it's between Norway and the US, which is the way it used to be. It's wow. Could be Spain, could be Germany. Brazil's gotten much better. Argentina's gotten better. So it's a different world than it was, but it still hasn't really flowed into American college sports yet. It's most likely a roster is going to be filled primarily with American girls, women.
I'd agree with that. And I think if you look back, and again, yeah, we're saying 11 years ago when I moved over here, like I think soccer was so high up. Women's soccer was so high up as an American sport. And I think across the world, even for me in England, it was like a group of three or four sports that the more athletic girls that were playing. And I think now it's football has got soccer, I'll say football sometimes. Football has gotten a lot more popular amongst women around the world, and I think a lot of other sports here have got a lot more popular here. So I think, like, and again, if you look at other sports that are really successful here at Mersey, our softball team just had a really good year. Our women's lacrosse team are always a really strong contender. But I think those sports have got a lot more participation in the last 10, 11 years because there's a lot more offerings, which again is great. Like, I love dual sport athletes, especially amongst high school players. Do I think that we get them as much coming to this level? No, but I think there's so much positives that you can take from it. But I think there's so much empowerment for female athletes within sport, and that's a really big part of it. And one of the things that I love the most about the job is working with the female student athletes on our team that work really hard to get to where they cut to get here from where they've come from. And we are quite a bit more diverse. I think it's five internationals next year, but we've got kids from California, we've got kids from West Virginia, we've got kids from Michigan, and seeing them all come together with different stories and again different backgrounds of how they might have played and who they were coached by and styles, and I think it all comes together and does great things. So I'm still excited to see obviously the direction that we continue to go within youth sports and collegiate sports. But I definitely think, yeah, been a big change over the last kind of 10, 11 years that I've been here in terms of how the landscape is.
How'd you get involved on the women's side?
So when I graduated in 2019, I came over to Mersey as a grad assistant with the men's program. Really enjoyed it. My background, I was a goalkeeper, so did a lot of the goalkeeper coaching and just kind of started to get involved with the women's team as well, and then transitioned more as to an assistant coach with the women's program. And just really enjoyed it. I think, and I don't know what it is. I think my coaching style has gone quite well with female athletes, which I really enjoy. I just really enjoy doing it. I like the process of the recruitment. I like watching. I like being a part of it. I think the way that I like to do things, like I think I'm quite a hands-on coach in terms of how we do things. I think the girls will know what exactly I want of them, and just really enjoyed it. I think as an assistant coach, we were really successful here, with Danny as the head coach, who I think been instrumental in me kind of taking the reins on my own and kind of running with it. But really enjoyed how he recruited the way that I like to play. I think we get the girls in that do it, and just kind of got on the saddle with the women's soccer game, and I think I've really enjoyed it
Right.
and want to keep running with it. Like, I'm super fortunate to have got a head coaching job at a program that over the last 10 years has been as successful as this, especially at I was 25 when I got the job. So getting that opportunity is one that I'm super grateful for from our staff here to have given me that opportunity. But just trying to run with it and keep it going. Last year kind of was the biggest taste of success that I've had as a head coach here, and
Just hoping to build on it, but
really enjoy it. And I still stay involved with the men's side here as well. Like me and Pedro are exceptionally close and definitely are at each other's games a lot, and we'll help each other out with practices. But I just love soccer. I love soccer. I love being involved with it, and I think
obviously trying to put a bit of what I've learned and what I've seen
into some other players as well, and have really, really enjoyed it.
what adjustments have you had to make moving from the men's to the women's side? What differences have you noticed, and what adjustments have you had to make?
That's a really good question. I think obviously the women's game is a little bit different, in terms of I definitely think the men's game has got a lot more direct and physical, whereas the women's game for me not so much. Like I definitely am a coach that likes to play a lot, so we try and bring in the right players that can do that but also compete physically, in the way that we're playing here. So definitely the type of player that we look to bring in. And then obviously look, with the constraints around scholarships and stuff at Division Two, we try and find the right players that are very good academically, and can stack that academic scholarship on top of athletic scholarship. So there's so many things we're looking at past just are you a good soccer player? As we touched on earlier, like obviously your attitude and your personality is a big part of it. Your academics, we want people coming here that are very good students. We take a lot of pride in our GPA as a team. And then obviously good soccer players too, because at the end of the day, you could have a great personality and be a great student, but if obviously you're not good enough to play at the level that anyone's recruiting you at, then we wouldn't do that to kids to bring them here where we didn't think they could play. But the mix of all three is definitely a really, really good thing that we look for. And yeah, just plugging in holes and figuring situations where we can bring the right players in to replace the voids that have been left from seniors and stuff. And I think obviously the men's side a lot more international based. Like Pedro has a lot of European players on his team, whereas we have three or four, and trying to mix them in with the Americans and the different style of which they play, is an important part of it too. So definitely a little bit different in terms of the recruiting that you're looking to do, the type of player obviously you're looking to bring in, but still a lot of similarities in the same way, because obviously you want the right personalities within your team that you enjoy working with. And again, I do think that's a really big part of building a successful team and a successful program.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. Yeah, I coached men and women for 8 years. I did it simultaneously, and you can't. I couldn't play the same systems. Couldn't ask the players to do the same things, in the same way. There were different deficiencies that the women would have in the technical side that the guys didn't struggle with, heading the ball, for example. Being able to head it with power, and so you just couldn't play the same way, and you couldn't ask them to do the same things. On the other hand, man, the women just gave you something as a person, as a coach, that the men didn't give, as far as being able to connect with them in a different way, and I found that quite interesting too. That there's differences in personalities and in how you can coach them and what you can say to them and how you can address them. It's fascinating for me, and it took me a it was hard switching for me, switching back and forth, literally from one session to the women and then next session for the men. I know my first year, Jack, we coached the men first in training and then the women, and I had to switch that immediately and forever. After that, I did the women first and then the men, because I would find myself, because of the men getting me so wound up, I'd find myself pissed off at the women for no good reason. And the women were just easier to deal with than the men. The men tested me at every moment. I had to be more wound up for the men than I needed to be for the women. I could chill out and relax a little bit on the women's side, more than I could on the men's side. Everything was just a little more intense with the men. It was like you were going to war all the time with the
Yeah,
men.
and I think that the recruiting the right personalities, I think, is big on that, because I think I'm quite an intense coach. Like, I'm very, if you're doing well, I'll let you know. If you're not doing well, I'll also let you know. So finding the right personalities that, and that's the one thing I always say. Like, I'm not a lot of recruits when they come on campus, and it is a very good question. Like, are all the girls really close? Yes. Because everybody has one common goal of wanting to win and wanting to be
Right.
successful, and they
Right.
push each other. But, and again, like, as a professional that's gone through your career, and I say this as well, like, you're going to work with some people that necessarily aren't your cup of tea all the time. You're not going to be someone that you're going to go out with them away from this. But when you're there, it's about mutually understanding the positives that you bring to environments. And when we turn up at the field, you would think that our team is exceptionally close, which they are. But then when they go away into the realm of their other lives, are there girls that are closer than others? Absolutely. But they push each other, and they work, and they want to be pushed. And I always say a big two words for our program here is positive but accountable. It's a really positive environment, but it's a group of girls that hold themselves really accountable. And I think they have a really mature outlook on that, in terms of when someone pushes them or says, hey, you need to be better, they deal with it and they take it on the chin, which is something I'm really thankful to have with the girls that we have here at Mercy, is the want to just consistently improve. And if they disagree, they're really mature about it. They'll talk about it at the end of practice. They'll just take it on the chin during practice and keep working. But I think that allows you to keep pushing each other. And it's really similar to how our men are here. So I'm quite lucky. If I ever do jump in with the men and take a session, I really don't think I have to change my demeanor, because we have a group of student athletes that are all so bought in into the winning. And I think that's a great mentality that we have in I think collegiate athletics now, is it's players that want to be there and want to win. And it allows you to push them as a coach, and it allows me to coach the way I want to be, the coach the way that I want to coach, and produce players that we want to produce and get the most out of. So I'm definitely really lucky as to how hard that I can push the group here, and how much they want to win and they want to be pushed. And again, that comes down to like I said, that the personalities that you're trying to recruit.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad you brought up something, and that's, people talk about, how close is the team? And because this is, look, I don't care what any coach says, this is human, this is a human nature thing. You can only have 3 to 5 close friends at any time. And then I think they say you can have about 11 casual relationships where you have a deep connection with them. But, psychologists have studied this stuff. There's no way that you can get 25, 28, 30 kids that are all best friends. It just never, it's not human nature. It's not how it works. So I think you've made a really good point, and I think that parents listening to this and players listening to this need to have an understanding of what this is probably going to be like when they go into college. That yes, they'll make friends with 1, 2, 3, 4 girls within the team, or sometimes without outside of the team. Sometimes it's a couple of softball girls that click with a couple of soccer players, right? And then that's the group of four. But to expect that the whole team is going to coexist peacefully with no conflicts is the most unrealistic thing I've ever heard of. And it is one of the reasons why I've heard players talk about transferring. It's like, oh, some of the girls don't get along. It's like, well, that's called life. That's normal. If you've got a family, a big family of cousins and five or six brothers and sisters and a bunch of cousins, there's going to be a bunch of people in that family that don't get along. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't still like each other.
Yeah, 100%. And like,
But it means you just can't have those conversations about the things that you don't agree with. That's all.
and what you just said there is a big part of it too, because I actually think, again, not being like always together and stuff, and being all pally pally with everybody, I think allows us to have such a good environment at practice, at games as well, because you're not bringing things from the outside to those environments. I think when we need them, when we need them and we want them to be close, like I know for a fact player one through player 30 on my roster will have the back of every single person on that team, and I know that because of how they are. They buy into what we want to do. They have one, everybody has at least one thing in common, and that's the reason that they're here. And there has to be a level of understanding that you're gonna come from different backgrounds, you're gonna be from a different place, you're gonna have different thoughts and views on different things in life, and that's absolutely normal. But then bringing those people together and then having a team atmosphere, that's the amazing part of it, is you can bring people from different environments into those situations and be okay with, right, I might not get on with that person that well. I might not be on the same page as that person. And it's funny, like I know a lot of like we like our team building stuff. We do some cool stuff in preseason, but I like to take more of a back seat on that. And the funny thing is, when I stopped doing mandatory things, they started doing more stuff on their own with team bonding events. Like once I stopped mandating things, you start seeing more team events pop up. Oh yeah, we were 25 of us were here doing this. We were all here doing that. We were all here doing that. And I'm like, that's what I want. I want you to want to do it on your own. And I think that's then when you make more meaningful relationships. And again, whether that's a super close one or an acquaintance that you respect a lot as a teammate, that's just what you want to do. And I think that's a really important thing to understand and relate, that you're not going to come into a situation where it's everybody's best friends, everybody's pally pally. Because again, at the end of the day, you have some really good players that aren't playing, and that's going to be a different relationship with. You might have roommates that your suite mate is playing 90 minutes every game and you're not. And that's going to create issues. And I think when you're not the best of friends, I think it kind of negates those issues a little more, and allows you to have a lot more level head about things while still having people that you can talk to and confide in, about not just soccer, but also stuff that's going on in your life as well. And that's obviously another important part of a very large piece jigsaw puzzle of college athletics and being a head coach of any sport and any program.
You're so far ahead of where I was at your age. I didn't seriously say this is what I want to do for a living coaching in college until I was 34. So to hear you already probably 10, you're probably 10 to 15 years ahead of where I was at your age, because it's so interesting that you said that you things started to get better when you stopped dictating so many things to your kids, making things mandatory. When I was 34, 35, 36, I wanted to run everything. I wanted everything run my way with the team, from how much, how we did team bonding and what I wanted them to do off the field and how I wanted them to run things. And it probably wasn't 8, 9 years into my career. I was in my 40s when I said, oh no, less is better. The less, the once we had a structure and an agreement of these are our common goals. Can we agree on that? That these are our common goals. This is what we want to do as a team. And that was, be the number one team in the country. That was always where it came down to. It's like, no, winning the conference title isn't squat. That's nothing. That's one little conference in one little area of the country. What does that really mean? If that's what our goal is, boy, are we selling ourselves short. So what's it going to take then to become a national championship, and we would set out our goals and our objectives towards then this is going to have to happen and that's going to have to happen. Once we had that structural framework in place, the less rules that I had, the tighter my team became and the better we got. So to hear you at your age already have some of that figured out warms my heart. I mean, it
Well,
really it makes me say to myself, this is the future. Your coaches like you is it's that's our future, future of the game.
I appreciate that. And it's really funny. Like in 2 or 3 years, I think I've learned a lot with obviously more responsibility as a head coach. And like we obviously talk through what our kind of goals are, what we want to not even just on the field, but like the mantras that we want to have of our program. And I think, excuse me, after my second year, so the fall of 24, I sat there and I'm reading through these things and I'm like, I'm asking them to do things that I definitely am not doing myself. And that's the hardest part. And like it's one of
I
those
love
that I
that
think
vulnerability. I love
is
that.
it. I'm a big believer of growth mentality and always trying to learn something every day. And I think blinded by the light of being, oh yeah, I'm a head coach at 25, I'm loving it. And I'm like, I wasn't open to learning things from them as well. And I think that's such an important part of being a head coach is you want them to learn from you, but I want to learn from them as well, right? What can I do differently? How can I change things? And I think, and one of the ones from last year, like trying to obviously play a certain way and do certain things. And I have one of the players in the office and Jack, what we're doing works in certain situations, but against this team and watching film, like I don't think it's going to work. And I'm sat there and I'm like, it's been working all season. Like, what do you mean? And then she showed me stuff and I'm like, oh yeah, you're right. It's not going to work if we do it the way we have been. And like seeing a kid then look at me and be like, she was like shocked that I was like, oh yeah, I'm wrong. You're right. And I think, but being open to that vulnerability is such an important part of having this job too. Like I say to the girls, I'm always okay with mistakes, right? Mistakes, then you don't intend for them to happen. If it's effort and energy, then that's different. But they make mistakes. Like we draw things up that someone does wrong. The same way, like I might sit there and plan a practice and think, oh my God, this is going to be amazing. And then I go down to the stand of the field and do it and it's toilet. And like I'm the first person at the end of that session be like, this wasn't supposed to go that way, because then I'll get frustrated, they get frustrated, and you have to be able to open yourself up and say, right, I
Right.
make mistakes as well, the same as you do. And I think that allows you to get closer. Like you have to be personable, you absolutely do. And I think that human nature of, right, hey, I make mistakes too, and I've got some things really wrong in my 3 years as head coach. And when I'm looking back at film and thinking about, right, an assistant coach suggested this and I was really built into what I wanted to do and we didn't, and that might have costed us a win, that might have costed us a point in an important game. So it's okay. Like I like to listen to my players. They see things on the field very differently to how I see things on the sideline. So definitely if I like people to tell me what they're feeling and what they're seeing. And at the end of the day, like ultimately is it my responsibility? Yeah, 100%. But it's not just my voice, and I think that's a really important part of leading a program, and then for me growing as a coach as well. Because again, like I said at the start, I'm super fortunate to be in this position right now, but I absolutely want to make the most out of it as well, and have what we have and keep building. Most importantly, the resume of this program, but then obviously for myself as a young coach too, like great opportunity. Like a lot of people really struggle to get their foot into the door at collegiate soccer, especially young men in the women's game. When I think I got a really good chance and a really good opportunity, and every day my goal is to make sure that I take that opportunity and repay the faith that it got given in me. And that's really what the goals are in doing things. Like, because at the end of the day, if I can be the best version of me as a coach, I think that reflects well on my program. That reflects well on our players, and it's going to help them be the best version of themselves too, which obviously for me as a Division II college head coach, like their success to me is the most important part of all of this. So trying to make sure they're enjoying what they're doing and have good relationships with each other and with us. And I think that's really an important part of being involved in collegiate athletics.
You know, one of the hot topics when you look at social media, obviously, and especially on the women's side, look that the men are not on social media like the women are, or aren't using social media for the same in the same way in insofar as recruiting goes. that the women's side has gotten bonkers with Instagram and Twitter primarily. Women posting everything about themselves and every even games and schedules and film highlights and tagging every coach in the country and trying to figure out how to get themselves recruited, which is funny to me. It's ironic because on the women's side, there is that there the demand for players outweighs the supply of players. And so you would think that it would be the opposite. You would think the men would be pushing themselves more on social media because on the men's side, there are far more players than there are college spots and availability. So the supply that the supply outweighs the demand. And on the women's side, it's the demand outweighs supply. I mean, I've still got Power Four schools right now. Some of the biggest names of schools in the country asking for female goalkeepers, for example. Now, here today, can't find the goalkeepers that they need, or can't find the center backs that they need, or everybody is looking for a striker, a goal scorer, right? Who can get me 24 points next year? It never stops, but on the women's side, there is a dearth. There is a shortage of quality players. So, what's your recruiting strategy? We hear online, well, you've got to play ECNL. That's the only way you're going to get recruited is to play ECNL. And I always rebuff at that because I have found all Americans that were playing in nothing leagues. I mean, literally a league that nobody's ever heard of leagues, and they are all Americans out there. But some coaches, will only recruit ECNL. That's it. They won't recruit transfer portal in ECNL is it.
I think it's always funny, right? And I think we had a good year last year, obviously second round of the NCAA tournament, top 25 in the country for a good portion of the season. I don't think I have one ECNL player on my roster. I think for me, we have a lot of players that, from our perspective as staff, are probably some of the better players from the better ECRL clubs. Sprinkled in with some kids that, again, like some of our transfers played ECNL and played Girls Academy, and then some Division One internationals as well in there. But look, again, part of it, do I think Division Two sometimes is finding a diamond in a different, like in the rough? 100%. But there's so much good soccer. I do think that the map of girls soccer at club level definitely is very jaded and makes it really difficult for college coaches to kind of know the best place to go. I think it's so spread out at this point where selfishly there probably has to be a better way to bring it back into a situation where it's easier to obviously recruit, but then less travel. You're playing the best players in the best teams against the best players in the best teams, and you're not going to a showcase and watching a top bracket game that ends 9-0. Like, nobody gets nothing from that. But I definitely think, look, there's some tremendous players that play ECRL. There's some tremendous players that play USYS, that play MPL. And it's about finding the right fit and the right things. We just had a player graduate last year, Anakshu Dixon, who's just graduated here with the points record, the goals record, the assists record, every record at Mercy. And she was playing on the second team of a club that played in USYS when she was getting recruited. So those players are there, and I think that's, for me, like, finding the right people that fit the right way to do things and be successful is one of the reasons that's helped us be successful. Because you can sit there as well. There are some players on ECNL teams that aren't as good as players on RL teams, that aren't as good as players on EDP teams, as MPL teams. Is that frequent? Probably not as frequent. No, but that is the case. So finding those players is important, in the same way that some of the best clubs in ECRL can compete with some of the mid tier, sometimes even the stronger tier ECNL teams. Like, that's on a bit more of a rare basis as well. But finding those clubs and those teams are important as well. So, and again, don't get me wrong, is it like I'm not taking ECNL players? No, but I think my ability to bring in stronger players from other platforms is more frequent, because I think obviously a lot of the ECNL players, I think D1 is more of the goal, and there is still sometimes that D1 mentality around things, which again I do completely understand. But finding the right players from the right environments and probably working hard to locate that and spending our time wisely is important, because I think obviously some programs have the luxury where kind of I think sometimes the recruiting gets done by itself because of how good the program is, where you are or what you're doing. And we definitely have to work hard to bring in the players that allow us to compete at the level that we want to compete at. Obviously as frequently as we do, and we hope to continue doing. But yeah, I think you've got to find the niche for you. You've got to find kids that I think work with the programs that you have. Like, we've got great nursing programs. I know there's some programs that really do frown upon taking players that are in that health science sort of and nursing way, where they're going to miss class, they're going to miss practice for classes sometimes and clinicals. Whereas for us, our nursing program's great. So if I can bring in a really good player here, but they might have to miss practice once a week, that's something that I have to live with. So finding the players that fit the mold of what we can offer and what we can do, and it doesn't matter what that level is. But no, if we do have any ECNL players here, it's not many. So and we
Yeah,
sound
no, and
okay with
the
that.
moral of the story is that I think you could agree with this, is that a youth player needs to be happy and be enjoying the game and be in an environment where they feel like they're being challenged enough and getting better and being coached and well and being around girls that they enjoy. You know, that they
100%.
enjoy their environment. 'Cause so for these parents out there listening that think the only way that their kid is going to play in college is to drive 4 hours to an ECNL practice 3 days a week, you know, be in the car for 8 hours, and this has to happen, and they're going to have to spend, you know, $25,000 a year for their kid to fly all over the country, that this is the only way that it's going to happen is it's a lie. It's a lie. It's a lie being sold by people who make money off of, you know, parents believing it. And it's not true. Is it a little easier for an ECNL girl because if they're good, they know they're going to be in front of a bunch of coaches? 100%. It's easier that as a friend of mine says, that the skids are greased. It's going to move a little bit smoother for them. On the other hand, you know, if you're playing on a struggling ECNL team that isn't very good and you're the 15th player on the roster, it's going to be maybe harder for you than if you're standing out on an NPL team or, you know, or on an EDP team. You're not going to stand out, and you're not going to get that leadership piece built into you of being able to help lead the team. And maybe because you're not playing as much, maybe you're not developing as well. You know,
100%.
so there's two sides to the coin, and I really want parents and players that are listening to this to understand that each kid is unique, right? There is no "This is the way you must do it." And having you on was, I thought, re really important for especially on the women's side, for people to hear that you can play college on a highly successful college team, even if you haven't been part of the pathway that everybody tells you must take.
100%, 100%. And again, I think it does come back to, is there a way that we can make this whole youth soccer system a lot more compact and easier to understand, so people aren't getting pulled in different directions? And obviously coach and club, I see it on that level as well. So no, look, playing at the right level for you as a player in the right environment is going to help you get to where you should be, and where you can be most successful. And at the end of the day, that's the most important part of it, right? Like I always say to my club kids, like, I'd rather you go somewhere where you are going to play. Like, I don't want to build players that are happy to go somewhere where they know they're not going to play very much. Like, I want you to go and play. I want you to go and enjoy it and be successful. And at the end of the day, provide opportunities to the players and the right opportunities to help them get to where they can get to and where they hopefully want to get to. And hopefully those two coincide with one another. But that's just an important part of it for me. Everybody has a place. Everybody has a home that's going to fit for them. And just making sure that we can do everything we can on the back end to make sure that's the right place is obviously important.
The other thing players I don't think about often enough. Look, like I said, I've coached in the NCAA and in NAIA. I've spent a short stint coaching pro, and I've coached at junior college. And at every one of those levels, we've been in that playoff run time of the year where team was doing well enough that and even in high school, I can think about where you're in that run, and the excitement was never different, whether it was coaching at the pros, or whether it was coaching in high school and youth, or the junior college level. The excitement was never different when you were in that playoff run and your team was clicking and doing well. Every team felt like they were in the World Cup. That they were doing really well. That's how the players felt. You could see it in their excitement and, wanting to come to training and talking about the last game or talking about the next opponent or, whether it was finally lifting that trophy. The excitement was always the same from the parents and the players. It wasn't, oh, the pro players were so much more excited than the high school kids. No,
Yeah.
they weren't. They weren't any more excited than the high school kids. It's just that once you get into the right environment with the right players and the right coaches, and you get into the season and things start to click, you're going to feel like you're playing in the World Cup.
Yeah,
It's
and I
going
think
to feel
that's
like you're playing in Europe.
such a big part of it as well is like, you'd never want to be a coach that takes away the enjoyment of the game, right? Like the higher level you go, the more demand there is for more success and more winning and stuff. But the moment that this doesn't become a game and you enjoy it and you have fun is the moment that someone's not doing their job a lot along the line, right? So for me, that enjoyment level is so imperative to especially club, but I'd be lying if I said I didn't try and bring that to the college environment too. Like, yes, is it more serious? Absolutely, of course it is. People are on scholarship money. It's a job that you're getting paid to do. But at the end of the day, there has to be that enjoyment factor. Like there has to be those smiles and
Absolutely.
those laughs and those bits of fun in there. And I want to be a part of that as well. So I think sometimes it's really easy to forget that when you're in it and you're under the pressures of it. And again, being a college soccer coach is a difficult job. Like I always say, my girlfriend is a saint for putting up with how much I'm not here, how much I'm doing stuff, and being a significant other of a college coach is a job in its own, in my opinion. But you're always balancing those things that if you come to work and you're not happy, like that's not the point in it. Like there has to be that enjoyment factor, and it's really big that translates to for me that translates to the product that I'm offering to the players and the enjoyment that I'm trying to get out of practice and stuff as well. But there always has to be that enjoyment factor, and that's a really big part of it.
Because you're involved in club, I think you're a good person to ask this question of, I notice that more on the women's side than on the men's side, I notice players that are very good players, very good. They obviously put some time into this game on their own at some point. They've taken it seriously, and they get to the point somewhere in that later high school years where they say, "Yeah, I'm done. I'm burnt out. I'm not going to play anymore past high school. I don't want to play in college." And I'm noticing that more on the girls' side. Always noticed it more on the girls' side than the guys' side. I mean, on the girls' side, I've seen flat out could play Power Four Division One and impact a team immediately, say, "No, I'm done. I'm done. And I don't notice that as much on the boys' side. Not that it doesn't happen. Of course, it must happen. But I don't notice it as much on the boys' side. So why do you think that is?
I mean, from the
Or are
couple.
you noticing that yourself? Do you find that to be true at all?
Yeah, I think for me, like our club play, our highest level our club play in is ECRL, and we have some really good players and some really good teams in that environment. For me, I think I've coached a lot of players on the club level that are really high academic student athletes or students in this case moving forward that could probably play on some mid to lower level Division Two and Division Three teams. And really enjoy soccer. I can't talk about it from the higher level because I don't think we've had players in that situation where they could play at that high of a level and choose not to. But these are players that are getting into some Ivy League schools, some probably just below that level that could go to, and I'll even put Mercy in the boat for that, like a player that could come to Mercy and play or could go to High Point and not play, or get into Duke and would not play. And I think it's weighing up, obviously, their life, what they want to do. And if they know they don't want to continue playing soccer or try and play at a high level, and they really want to go and have that college experience in a school that offers a lot more than some of these smaller schools, where smaller Division Two and Division Three schools where they could go and play, I think that's a big part of it. And I think I coach a lot of really mature young female athletes in club. I have the two oldest teams, and the fact that they are in a position where they are comfortable choosing something that they think and they believe is right for them is something that I'm super proud of in what they do. And I think that's a part of it. I think they very much know what they want to do and where they want to go, and they follow that. And I think that's a testament to them as obviously as students going into the next part of the world, and they know what's best for them, and I trust that. Is it obviously a shame when like you really love to see someone play at college and things like that? Of course it is, but there's also that sense of pride around it as well, that you know they're following what they think is right for them. And even like some of them, like I can't remember what school, but they've got a really, really good club soccer program, and she plays on that and she loves every minute of it, and that's kept her loving and enjoying soccer whilst being able to be at a school that helps her achieve her goals and get her to where she wants to go. And that's a big part of it too. At the end of the day, obviously I have my club hat on and I have my college cat hat on and at different times, but them doing what they want to do to better themselves and put themselves in the right environment, at the end of the day, that for me is the most important part. But I think we see a lot more younger female athletes that are doing that and putting themselves first as opposed to trying to do something just to do it. Like, and I think that's a big part of it. And I think that's a good way to do things, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, and honestly, I'm with you in that I've got a lot of respect for mature young players that figure that out. I've got a young man that we were helping that got into Cal Berkeley, but he was never going to play at Cal Berkeley and decided exactly the same thing. He decided to play club at Berkeley, so that he could get the education that he wanted. And I've got a lot of respect for that. I encourage young players to have open conversations with their parents about what's important to them. And I think the other part that you haven't touched on, but I do think it's out there. I think there is this burnout with some of these kids. And I think we've got kids that are tired of soccer being their entire life. Like, I had to miss my junior prom because of soccer, and I had to, I didn't get to date as much. I didn't get to hang out with my friends as much. I didn't get to do, I didn't get to do, I don't know, debate club or be part of these social circles or do as much with my church or whatever because of soccer. And I just want to be a normal kid for a while. I just want to be a normal student for a while, and I'm tired of it being my whole life. I think there is that. We've created that with ECNL and with GA, and we've created that because there's a lot more traveling And in some areas of the country, there's a lot less teams, so that means they have to travel more for practice. And I mean, I literally talk to parents who travel 3 hours one way and 3 hours the other way to a training session, and they're asking me is when do I decide if that's what we need to do if we want to play in college? And my answer is always, as we've discussed earlier, never. You don't ever have to do that if your goal is just to play in college. If your kid's good, there's other ways to figure this out. But I think that burnout piece is also happening. And I think it's part of what we are seeing with the transfer portal. Because the statistics that are coming out of the transfer portal are not really encouraging, Jack, if a player is wanting to continue to play, in that it's somewhere, it varies every year, but somewhere between 40 and 50% of the players that enter the portal never come out of the portal. It's as the joke is, not a joke, but it's where some players go to die as far as their careers go. And I think part of that is by player design. It's got to be hard, and I really feel for these players, but it's got to be hard to tell mom and dad, yeah, you invested $100,000 in my youth career, and I'm done. I don't want to play in college. So the result is, mom and dad, well, come on, you can't really be done. Just try it. Try it for a year. Just go into college for a year. Yeah, I'm really done. I don't want to do this. Well, just for a year. Just try it. You don't want to regret. You don't want to have regrets. At least try it. So they go and they say, it's miserable. I want to enter the portal. And then they never leave the portal. That's it. It's their way of telling mom and dad without telling mom and dad. And of course, not every player. Of course, I'm generalizing. But
Yeah, and I think
there's a good chunk of players out there. There's a good chunk that I think this applies to.
I think it's really easy to forget in the whole process that, first of all, the student athlete is the most important part of the process, whether it be recruiting, whether it be the transfer portal. They are the most important thing. And even sometimes, like, I think you have to remind yourself, me included, that behind the student athlete, there's also a person that has to do the right thing for them. And I think from lots of different directions and different figures, that's sometimes forgotten. And it's easy to forget that. Don't get me wrong. You've got people that have different stakes in it. As a college coach, we're bringing players in to win for our program. As parents, again, youth sports in general in this country is astronomically expensive at the moment. There's a lot of investment from there. It's really easy to forget that there is a person behind all of that. And I think that's sometimes the most important part of this. And that probably comes to where we see people drop out, where we see people go in the portal and not find a new home. Or maybe they go in the portal to look for a new home and decide that, you know what, I'd rather stay at XYZ school where I've built relationships and built friends and not play on the team. And again, there's a massive sense of maturity in making that decision too, because that must be a one of the more difficult ones to probably decide to do. But yeah, look, I mean, the world in general is evolving very quickly, right? I mean, how people are now is very different to how people were 10 years ago and 10 years ago and 10 years before that. But yeah, it's interesting to obviously see how lots of different things change and how lots of different things go, and obviously the transfer portal does have a big impact in collegiate sports in general, and yeah, the data of how many people find new homes is probably a lot lower than you'd want it to be. But I just think that's the reality of the world we live in now, with the amount of players coming through the younger systems ready to come in, and the players that we're seeing from other parts of the world come and join the sports system and the sports pyramid here. And that's something that again, no one really has answers to, right? Because you don't know how quickly it's going to change or where it's going to change from. So just got to obviously stay relevant to those situations and be aware of what's going on. But yeah, definitely lots of changes for sure.
Well, us old timers that have been around that I coached for, it's been, oh, it's, well, the beginning of my career was coaching was, so I was, it's been, probably been 35, 37 years, 37 years now. Have things seen things change so rapidly over the last 3 to 5 years that it's really, it almost overwhelming for us, which is what makes me glad that we've got the next generation of younger coaches. And really, honestly, when I finally stepped away from coaching in college, the final determination was, I'm too old school for the younger generation of players, and it really was time to pass the baton on to people who understood what the current generation of player was going through. Because now we've got our first generation of collegiate players who don't know a life before the smartphone. They don't know what the world was like before the smartphone. And that is creating a different mentality in the players. And I think that they need younger coaches like yourself to understand them a little bit better and what they were going through, what they're going through, and how rapidly, as you said, the world is evolving, which can't be easy. AI is going to change, how a lot of these kids are graduating with jobs that may not be there in 10 years. We don't know, and they're going to have to adapt, and they're going to have to be adaptable and flexible. And
100%.
I think that having coaches that are a little more flexible, rather than, guys like me that were a little more rigid, we had a specific way of doing it, is probably best for these kids. What's next on the, now that the kids have graduated, left, gone home for the summer, what's next for a college coach in the summer? Like, how does your summer go, and when do you start seeing things pick up again, as far as the soccer goes?
We start quite early this year. We come in August 9th, which definitely looking forward to. Kind of in a unique position where we only graduate three players next year, so the recruitment for 27 is kind of done. So what we see this year is probably going to be pretty consistent over 2 years, which I'm really excited about. So definitely going to try and wind down for a little bit. I think for me, like, I try and from now kind of into June, definitely try and take some me time in there, and then July we'll start preparing a bit more for how things will look when preseason comes in. But yeah, definitely, hopefully watch England pick up a World Cup in America would be nice.
Yeah, you're dreaming, but it's okay. It's okay to dream. It's okay to have big dreams.
That one can only hope, right? But no, definitely looking forward to the World Cup
It'll
here.
be
My
fun.
parents, my parents are coming over from England for a couple of weeks, which is always really nice. So yeah, hopefully getting a few rounds of golf with Dad and go and do some cool things with both of them, because it's obviously really nice when they get to come over and I get to spend some time with them. But yeah, I mean, I'd be lying if I said I wish I couldn't wake up tomorrow and it was August 9th, because I really am excited for this year and this group that we have coming back. And again, like I said to you briefly before we started, like, working in collegiate athletics, your job is so much more fun when the student athletes are here. And we're a smaller department at Mercy. We've only got 10 teams. So we have a really good atmosphere and relationships between all of our coaches, all of our student athletes. And when they're not here, the job's definitely not quite as fun. So just making sure I can refresh and recharge and get those batteries ready for a season that we really hope we can continue to push and build on from next year. But we know how hard we have to work for that to happen, and I think there's a really good attitude that the girls have for wanting that to happen. So just rest, recharge, get ourselves set, and then hopefully as soon as we start on day one, we can hit the ground running and go from there. But very excited for it, and to see kind of where we can go over the next well, see where we're at come the end of November. Obviously, hopefully still playing and still on the sidelines.
Yeah, you say August 9th, and you said that's early for you. It's crazy because Division One now is almost a month ahead of that. And it's so wild when people don't understand, but That's why I love these conversations. But in every area of the country, even it's different. When I was at Feather River up here coaching, we were it was always August 1 that our kids came in August 1. And then, when I was at Cal State East Bay, it was about the 9th. It was roughly around that time. And but now Division One is reporting in July officially. And it's crazy how the calendars are not as aligned as they used to be.
100%, 100%. And again, like, I mean, it definitely, I think, obviously, Division One may start their games a little bit earlier as well. But just that kind of, it's a from quite a while ago, but the life in the balance, the make it yours part of Division Two, I think we have a good start date. I mean, some schools start very early. Some schools like start school the middle, the end of August. We don't start till towards the end of September, towards the beginning of September, sorry. So it's still nice that we get a really dedicated period of time that we can just come in and really focus on that soccer, and us being in the right place for that. But yeah, again, just different platforms and
I do
different.
think that helps. Yeah, some schools have a trimester system, which is wild that they have to start school so early. They start school literally about the same time soccer does, and I like the way that you guys do it because it lets the kids settle in with the soccer a little bit and then start school,
A
and
hundred percent.
it's less hectic, less
A
hectic.
hundred percent. But no, I really enjoyed having the conversation. It's nice. I definitely keep in touch with the conversations that you have on social media, and I like how you're happy to talk about some of the subjects that are definitely hot ones at the moment. But definitely really nice to get on here and speak a little bit more about Division Two and kind of how we look at things and how we do things. And really enjoyed having a chat.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate you very much, man. And yeah, recharge those batteries. So important. And then yeah, then time to go win an Addy.
I'm gonna definitely try our hardest to do that. So no, I appreciate it. And yeah, look forward to having some more conversations further down the line.
Yeah, we'll do it. We'll do this again. This has been a good one, Jack. I
Awesome.
appreciate it. We'll do it again.
No worries, mate. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks, buddy.